Hi, my name is Sarah Ladislaw. I'm a senior fellow here in the Energy and National Security Program at CSIS, and welcome to this morning's conversation. We thought maybe we'd talk about healthcare since we haven't heard a lot about it in the last couple days. But then we thought, no, let's stick with what we know. So this morning's event is actually about, it's entitled Resurrecting the Patchwork. And we're actually pretty excited for this event because it's something we talk a lot about. And something that people have been asking us a lot about when we sort of go out on the road talking about global energy trends and what the future policy landscape looks like. And so we're really pleased to have today with us some experts who do a lot of thinking about, you know, where the future of policy, energy and climate policy in particular, is coming from and what we can hope to expect in terms of having top-down policy, something federally or internationally coordinated, versus more of the bottom-up strategies that we saw in the late sort of, well, early to late 2000s. And one of the reasons we sort of decided to do this is, you know, to sort of explicitly recognize the fact that over the last several years, you know, there's been this expectation that 2009 in many ways was going to be a pivotal year. It was going to be a pivotal year not only because the United States would have new U.S. would have new presidential leadership, and hopefully with that coming some sort of new type of approach to energy and climate policy, one that many in the international community sort of hoped would be much more engaged in terms of finding an aggressive pathway towards dealing with climate change, engaging sort of the international community on what it wanted to do in terms of climate change, but also bringing those policies home to bear in a coordinated sort of federally top-down manner. And not saying, you know, a lot of folks had asked sort of in the lead-up to this event whether we were generally pessimistic about prospects for an international agreement, prospects for national climate policy here in the United States. And I don't know that we're necessarily pessimistic, but we do recognize that it's 2010 and that some things have transpired over the last year. Energy and climate policy didn't come together as aggressively as or as quickly as perhaps the Obama administration had hoped. Still very much on the agenda, as we see from the news each and every day. But, you know, prospects for actually passing legislation this year into next year increasingly look questionable. So, and on the international front, we had a what some would deem, and I would even deem, a relatively successful meeting in the end of 2009 in Copenhagen. But at the same time, prospects for where that agreement is actually going to go, how much top-down globally coordinated policy that will yield at the upcoming meeting in Cancun at the end of this year is still sort of an open question as well. And so the question is, if that's the landscape, if that's really what we're looking at, and you can sort of challenge that hypothesis as well if you like, then what happens? Do we revert back to some sort of bottom-up patchwork strategy that we saw, as I had said, through much of the 2000s that gave political leadership not only sort of the political courage but also sort of the wherewithal to enact policies that sort of dealt with climate change in terms of, you know, not only here in the United States but also around the world? Or has that changed as well? Is there still sort of that appetite for local leadership, national leadership? And what's the difference? Why does it matter whether or not there's sort of top-down coordinated policies or something more of a patchwork framework? And so we're really pleased today to have, as I said, three people who I, you know, definitely look to in terms of their expertise in the fields that they work in to talk to us about sort of three aspects of this question going forward. The first is Elliot Duringer from the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, where he's the Vice President for International Strategies. Elliot has a long history doing environmental work, both sort of inside and outside the government. He's worked at the White House, worked at the CEQ, and has been deeply engaged in all manner of the international processes going forward on climate change. The next is Kate Zyla, who's now the Director of Research and Policy Analysis at Georgetown University's State and Federal Climate Resource Center, where she works on state and sort of local-level policy initiatives, including some of the regional greenhouse gas cap-and-trade programs. It's a pleasure to have Kate back here. Kate was one of our co-authors and partners in our work over the last couple of years with the World Resources Institute, so it's always good to have Kate back. And then finally, Bill Tindall, who's the Senior Vice President for Federal Government and Regulatory Affairs at Duke Energy for their Strategy, Policy, and Regulatory Group. Not only does Bill have a long history and sort of working on these issues within the private sector. But he's also played, and as Duke has played, a pivotal role in the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, which has been deeply engaged in sort of trying to discuss and figure out ways forward for policymakers in terms of energy and climate policy here in the United States. So what we're going to do is each of our panelists can speak for about 15 minutes, kind of give us their perspective on the prospects or the hypothesis that I laid out there, and then we'll open it up for a discussion about some of the sort of deeper questions about how we move forward. So Elliot first.
And hopefully you heard my opening remarks and can now hear me even better. And I think the question is really, where are we along that continuum and where do we need to be? If we're talking about two ends of the continuum, maybe it's helpful to start by defining in their pure form, what do we mean by top-down, what do we mean by bottom-up? And in the context of an international climate regime, I think you might describe a top-down approach as one that sets a quantified long-term goal and then uses an agreed formula to distribute responsibility for achieving that goal in the form of binding targets. I think that's the most conventional notion of a pure top-down model. And, you know, you hear the Kyoto Protocol often referred to as a top-down approach, but I think, in fact, it doesn't fit the pure model. In that case, you do have binding targets, but they weren't negotiated in that fashion. It wasn't that we agreed that we're going to achieve a collective reduction of X percent and then had some formula to distribute that. Rather, the targets that are in the Kyoto Protocol were a result of political bargaining. In a way, you might describe that negotiation as a bottom-up negotiation toward these binding targets. On the other end of the spectrum, bottom up. What's a pure bottom up approach in the international climate context? I would define that as a case of countries pledging national actions that they have full latitude in deciding. They have full latitude in their choice of policy mechanisms. They have full latitude in setting the stringency of those policy mechanisms. And again, these are pledges. These are not binding actions. So on the one hand, pure top-down, binding targets, formulaic approach to get to them. On the other hand, voluntary actions defined purely at the national level. And I think really what we need is something of a blend of the two, something that combines the best features of these two polar ends of the spectrum, if you will. So what are the best features? I think one of the virtues of a bottom-up approach is the flexibility that it offers. It does give countries some choice of their approaches, makes it easier for them, therefore, to align their domestic policies with their international commitments. That makes it easier for them to align their climate policies with other domestic priorities, other domestic objectives, whether that's energy security, reducing local air pollution, what have you. So the flexibility affords them that opportunity. And by virtue of that, it makes it easier to get countries into a regime. So the real virtue, I think, of greater flexibility is that enables you to achieve broader participation, which is certainly something we need if we're going to get a serious collective effort going. Now, there's an obvious downside there. If everyone does just what they want, and if nobody's bound to anything, you might very well tend toward a least common denominator approach. In other words, too much flexibility gives you too little effort. So if we look then at the other end, at the top-down approach, what are the virtues of that? And I think I would put at the top of the list the integration and the cohesion that you get from a top-down approach. And I think one important element of that integration is its bindingness. Why is bindingness important? I think that in order to achieve the strongest overall effort, countries need to be confident that others are putting forward their best effort. One country is going to put forward its best effort only if it's confident that, its counterparts are as well. And I think the best way to ensure that kind of reciprocity is through some form of binding commitments. But it's more than, binding this, this integration and cohesion that you get from the top down. There, are common institutions as well. You have common approaches to reporting and review, finance mechanisms. Ultimately, hopefully, you have some carbon market linkage. So these are all some of the benefits you would get from a more top-down approach. They give you greater consistency, greater coordination, greater efficiency, and ultimately greater rigor. So again, I think the challenge really is to strike the right balance between flexibility on the one hand and integration on the other hand. And this is a balance that can and should evolve over time. This is not a static situation. Now, I think you can look at other international regimes and see, in fact, how that balance between flexibility and integration has moved over time. You can look at regimes and see that many of them start out with a more flexible and voluntary approach, and over time, they become more integrated and more binding. So just a couple of examples. Within the trade regime, for instance, back in the GATT days, you start out with more of a pick-and-choose structure to tariff reduction. You have a number of optional codes on non-tariff barriers, and this over time evolves into what we have today in the WTO, which is a broader package of agreements that countries or members have to sign onto as a whole, and you now have a strong compliance mechanism. So you see that type of evolution there. Similarly, in the Law of the Sea, back in 1958, you begin with four parallel conventions, and countries have the option to choose one or more. And this, by 1982, had evolved into a single comprehensive convention with a strong dispute settlement mechanism. So I think it's that type of evolution, and none of these are direct analogs to the climate change situation, obviously, but broadly speaking, I think it's that type of evolution that we need to see in the case of climate change. Now, one important thing to note is that in the case of the other regimes, that evolution took decades, and we don't really have that kind of time in the case of climate change. So given that sort of context, how do you look at the Copenhagen Accord? Where do you situate it on that continuum? I think clearly it is closer to the bottom-up end of the spectrum. It's not binding. Countries define their pledges unilaterally, but I wouldn't say it's purely bottom-up. Developing countries have full flexibility in defining their actions under the Copenhagen Accord. But developed countries do not. The accord provides for a common type of action for all of the developed countries. They have all listed economy-wide emission reduction targets for 2020. So there you see some bounding of the type of actions for at least one group of countries. The Copenhagen Accord also envisions an architecture that I think over time can evolve into something that's more characteristic of a top-down approach. It calls for the reporting of emissions inventories by all countries, frequent reporting of actions, processes for review of the information that's reported, international consultation and analysis in the case of developing countries. It establishes a long-term finance commitment and calls for the establishment of a Copenhagen Green Fund. And to operationalize these things will require a comprehensive long-term financial architecture. So effectively, I think at this stage, what you have in the Copenhagen Accord is a pledge and review system, a non-binding system, with countries defining their actions unilaterally within some bounds, as I said, in the case of developed countries, and with reporting and finance systems that remain to be elaborated. So it's a very flexible approach, in that sense, bottom-up, and by virtue of that flexibility has, in fact, achieved broad participation. You have, for the first time, explicit pledges from all of the major economies. So where do we go? How do we move that further along the continuum toward closer to the top-down end of the spectrum? A couple of things. At some point, I think we are going to need to establish that a comprehensive binding agreement is, in fact, the goal. We did not leave Copenhagen with that as an agreed goal. Before Copenhagen, there was an effort to define expectations as a political agreement that would serve as a stepping stone toward a future binding agreement. Well, we got the political agreement, but there was no consensus around that second step. It kind of fell off the table. We need to get it back on the table. I think that we may well be at some risk at this point of losing sight of that goal. There are significant players that may be very content to stop right here with the pledge and review system and go no further than that. Binding remains the stated objective for most, if not all, parties, but they have very different notions of what that means, and I think the level of commitment to actually getting there ranges quite considerably. So again, I think that we will need within the climate process to establish that as a clear goal. I'm not confident that we can get to that even in the course of this year. But more immediately than that, I think what we need to do is to begin to build out the regime on the basis of the political understandings that you do see reflected in the Copenhagen Accord. We need to start filling in, if you will, the connective tissues of this regime, putting in place the mechanisms and the guidelines that could, in fact, begin to operationalize the Copenhagen Accord. So on measurement, reporting, and verification, we need to establish the guidelines for the submission of inventories for this international consultation and analysis process, perhaps anything more that may be needed on the developed country side as well. On the long-term finance side, we need to decide on the structure of this new Copenhagen fund that's supposed to be established and begin to establish the long-term architecture that it's going to fit into. In the case of forestry, red, we need to decide on the actual mechanisms that are going to provide support for that. The same on adaptation. And I think some of these things may well, in fact, be reasonable goals for the conference later this year in Cancun. Decisions on the operational elements that can begin actually putting the Copenhagen Accord into practice. Now, at the same time that we're building out the regime, I think one thing that we need to do is for countries to move forward domestically and begin to implement the actions that they've now pledged. And I think as we proceed along both of these tracks, we're building confidence. These are all avenues of confidence building. As countries act, they become more confident in their ability to act. They also see other countries acting and are more confident that, in fact, others are going to be stepping up to the plate. And as we begin to build out the regime, we see the regime taking shape. And we can be more confident about that. It's no longer a question of signing yourself up to some theoretical binding structure, but it becomes concrete before you're approached with the question of binding. And as you see it, as you build confidence, as you see the regime taking shape, it over time becomes more approachable to think about actually binding yourself to a regime. In a sense, this is a reverse of the Kyoto model. In the case of Kyoto, we negotiated the actual legal text. We then spent a few years elaborating in great detail a full system on paper that would put that agreement into practice before countries then actually proceeded to ratifying and bringing the agreement into force. What I'm suggesting here is that we build the system first and that we see the binding agreement as the culmination or the capstone, if you will, of the effort rather than as the necessary foundation for moving forward. Now, I do think it's going to take some time to get there, to get to a binding agreement. I think that's one of the clear lessons of Copenhagen, that it's going to take a lot longer than many had ever imagined. I think that Copenhagen was perceived as a failure by many in large part because the expectations were wildly unrealistic. We never thought that we would get to a legal agreement in Copenhagen, even though that did seem to be the common expectation for most right up until the time of Copenhagen. I'm encouraged that some of those who were most responsible for setting those unrealistic expectations now appear to be taking a more realistic view of what might be achievable this year in Cancun. Both Connie Hedegaard and Ivo de Boer have suggested that we're not going to get to a binding agreement this year, and I would certainly agree there. But they have both suggested that that should be the aim for next year in South Africa, and I think that still may be a little overly ambitious. It wouldn't surprise me in the least if it takes us 3 years or more to transform what we have in the Copenhagen Accord into a binding agreement. the problem is urgent. Climate change, the climate challenge is urgent, and there shouldn't be any denying of that. But in terms of what we need most at this stage, I'm not sure I would argue that a binding agreement is what's most urgently needed to address it. Action on the ground, domestic laws, I think those are the most urgent needs. And with those, we can move ourselves further in the direction of a binding agreement. So I think, just to sum up, I think what we need to do is we need to set our sights on the goal of a comprehensive binding agreement. We need to appreciate that it's going to take time to grow into it, and we need to do the things that we need to move further along the continuum in that direction. We need to get to the point where we still have enough flexibility in the system to keep everyone on board, but also have the cohesion and the integration and the bindingness that you need in the regime to ensure a strong overall effort. And let me stop right there. Exactly. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And, you know, to Elliot's credit, I think the Pew Center for Global Climate Change, Elliot and Eileen and the leadership over there, were sort of the first and earliest sort of within town to talk about setting expectations appropriately for Copenhagen. And even when it wasn't a very popular thing to say, and I definitely tend to agree with the tack they took there. So it's good to know what your expectations are for the next couple of years. Next up will be Kate Zyla.
I'm actually going to pull up some slides. Thank you, Sarah and CSIS, for having me back. I've got a few slides, largely because I got a bunch of maps, and those are fun. And largely thanks to the Pew Center, which is a great resource for state maps and which we borrow from heavily. Let's see what the slide shows. Okay, so I'm going to say just a couple words about the Georgetown Climate Center because we're pretty new and most folks don't know who we are yet. We are a center formed last February at the Georgetown Law School, and we focus on the intersecting roles of state and federal policy. So I'm going to shift things down a level to talk about the state patchwork instead of the international patchwork. We do some policy analysis and legal analysis on the way that the state and federal roles interact and sort of where the best level of regulation might be. We also work with a variety of states, governor's offices, environmental agencies, energy agencies. We are helping out a group of states that have joined and called themselves the Governors Energy and Climate Coalition, which formed last year. And they're a group of over 30 governors of states and territories who spoke out on two principles last year, the first being that they supported strong federal climate policy, climate and energy policy, I should say, and the second being that they also supported a strong role for states in that policy. And so I'm going to echo a little bit of what Elliot said about it not being an either-or situation, that you can have strong state roles and a strong federal program, and they can work together. So a quick note on why states have climate policies, why states have energy policies. They're doing them for a variety of reasons. It's about their energy supply. It's about their economic development. It's about climate change. It's about energy prices. It's about air quality. It's about a bunch of things they're regulating anyway, land use, utilities. And it's about them seeing the impact of climate change firsthand in their own states. A few maps to show you sort of what this patchwork actually looks like. This is a map from the Center for Climate Strategies. These are all states that have climate action plans. I believe it's 33 states have or are in the process of creating climate action plans. A map courtesy of the Pew Center. State renewable portfolio standards. This also includes what are called clean energy portfolio standards or alternative energy portfolio standards, so it's not all renewables. Adaptation plans are a little bit behind the mitigation efforts, but several states in the last couple of years have come out with adaptation plans. You know, this in many cases, it's coastal, but not entirely, because different parts of the country have different impacts they are currently seeing and will see from climate change. So Utah, for example, is worried about droughts. Vermont's worried about maple trees, Florida's worried about coasts and flooding. And so because there are these regional impacts, there are regional concerns and regional priorities evolve and appear in these climate plans. One of the most exciting initiatives I'm going to talk a little bit more about today are the regional cap and trade programs. There are three regional initiatives existing and emerging in the country altogether. I believe it's 23 or 24 states participate in one or more of them. Several states and provinces are either members or observers of multiple regions. And you'll see it covers a fairly large portion of the country and most locations in the country. I'm going to talk a little bit in particular about REGI, which is in the Northeast, because this is the only program that's currently up and running in the U.S. It is a cap on power sector emissions of CO2 only. So it's just one sector and it's just one gas, but it's already up and running. And a few things that REGI has done that are, I think, notable. One is to, actually I'd say the most notable is to auction almost all of the allowances that the program is issuing. They started out with an agreement that each state would auction at least 25% of their allowances, and several of them auction 100% or almost 100%. All of them auction at least half, I think. REGI's had 7 auctions so far. They've sold more than 200 million allowances, and those allowances are primarily getting in the hands of regulated entities. They have a third-party market monitor, and have been very careful about their auction design, their auction process, and the opportunity to use it as a model for federal legislation. So we see emergence of states as a laboratory for laboratory of democracy. You can see that the auction process has been a laboratory for what might happen at the federal level. It's been a pretty successful program financially. They've raised more than $580 million, most of which has been reinvested in other energy programs. 9 out of 10 states are investing over 80% of the money in efficiency and renewable programs. The governor of Maine has recently said that he attributes the creation of 1,000 jobs to REGI, and there have been some really great quotes from the commissioners of the New Hampshire PUC and the Maine PUC. That's called off the bottom. Dave Littell is the commissioner in Maine. The DEP in Maine, about the jobs that are being created by REGI and the money that's being invested in REGI in the energy supply sectors and efficiency sectors. The Western Climate Initiative is both states and provinces, and it's multi-sector, so that's a little bit scope beyond what REGI's tried so far. They have not started the way REGI has. They have design recommendations that came out at the end of 2008. They've been working since then on developing all the details of the program, but it greatly expands the geographic scope and the sectoral scope of a regional trading program. And the Midwest has a similar sort of process where they're also working with states and provinces. They're also looking at a multi-sector, multi-gas program. They had a further complicated process by bringing the local regional stakeholders into the negotiations from the very beginning. So you see companies, environmental organizations, the general public involved in all of these conversations. And I think maybe most exciting for me has been to watch these three regions start talking with each other. And we talked about the desire for federal policies to bring, I think, cohesion and coordination were some of the words in the description of today's event. We talked about the concerns about too many different programs, setting too many different standards. These states and provinces are in this patchwork are actually sort of bringing cohesion to themselves in some ways. They're meeting pretty regularly with each other and talking about their own programs. They're talking about the policies they're setting, the processes by which they're setting them. They're giving each other advice. They're asking, how did you approach that problem? How did you approach that problem? They're comparing notes. And in many cases, they're talking about how they might link or otherwise work together on these programs. So does it make sense to bring all of these emissions trading systems into one program? Does it make sense to look at the low carbon fuel standards emerging in each of these regions and think about ways that they might be coordinated, possibly harmonized in some ways, possibly not in others? They can bring the regional concerns they all have and think, okay, we do this differently, but does it make sense to do them the same way in some cases and not in other cases? So it's not as if these are happening in a vast vacuum. They're actually talking together quite a bit. And I'm going to be a little bit contrarian here, which is to start with Elliot's point that it's not an either-or situation, and say that in some ways the patchwork can be really beneficial for climate and energy policy. And in fact, that might even be the case if there's still federal policy. The states can be partners rather than an either-or situation. So on one hand, states can enact complementary policies that reduce the cost of meeting federal policies. They can innovate and provide new ideas to federal policy. They can address sectors that the federal government may not really have its hands on, land use, transportation, forestry, et cetera. They can tailor policies to meet local goals and local resources and local needs, and that's true for energy policies with local resources. That's true for adaptation policies with different impacts. And they can provide a backstop for federal policies that don't go as expected, or if an administration comes in that isn't as keen on enforcing or on regulating, states can step up and strengthen programs. They can also use those strengthened programs as a catalyst for further federal action down the line. And lastly, I'm going to be a little contrarian here and say that they might actually be thought of as increasing investment stability through a patchwork rather than decreasing it. You hear a lot about the desire for some sort of clear signal that's uniform across the country. You might think about overlapping policies as actually providing robustness that wouldn't be there if there's only one federal program that might be in jeopardy of lax administration or repeal or poor enforcement or anything else. If you have bills come up where, say, a Murkowski-type bill that try to step back what the EPA can do in some way, you wouldn't have to worry about losing an authority if you have a lot of overlapping authorities to step in. That's all.
Okay, great. Thank you. And next, we'll hear from Bill.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for inviting me to this discussion. It's an interesting day in Washington because supposedly, the Kerry Graham Lieberman team, three senators and their staff, are briefing a series of U.S. senators today on their proposal to put together, continue to try to put together a comprehensive U.S. bill, which, if you think about where we are, I suppose it's a little bit like healthcare, where it's been declared dead many, many times, and yet some version of it seems to keep going. But let's talk a little bit about the world of where we don't have an overarching international agreement, which I think Elliot did an excellent job of describing, the current status and the current expectations around that. We have a patchwork of state programs which, depending, of course, on where your company operates, for those of us in the private sector, have varying degrees of importance, and then you have this big question mark about what's going on at the federal level. So let me approach this as representing a company that is looking for certainty, looking for signals, is a consumer, if you will, of the need for some sort of structure here, and talk about sort of how we view this in terms of where we are right now and what the future holds as we see it, as anyone can guess where it's going. So Duke Energy, as was mentioned, has been in the forefront largely through the vision of our CEO, Jim Rogers, on the fight for climate change. He and I actually in the 90s worked on and established what I think was the first voluntary carbon cap for a utility in the U.S. that we negotiated with the Environmental Defense Force the Environmental ED at the time, and which was going to be publicly disclosed and monitored, and we started down that path, and then the company that was Synergy, and we merged with Duke, and so that's morphed since then. But as was mentioned, Duke was one of the founders of the U.S. Climate Action Partnerships, and we have been very actively running our head against the wall of the U.S. Senate trying to pass climate legislation. And so why do we do this? Well, Jim talks a lot about three numbers: 3, 12, 41. And it's not so much a confession as just sort of saying there's a business risk here. And what is that? Well, three, we're the third largest emitter of CO2 in the United States. 12 of the companies in the world were the 12th largest. And 41, if we were a country, we would be the 41st largest emitter of CO2. So we have exposure on this issue. And we are trying to find a way forward. And part of that is as you look at making investments and taking a step back, our sector tends to, power sector, tends to make large investments that have a long life. So you've got it. We have to know what the rules are. And right now, what are we doing in the face of sort of the uncertainty you've heard described? We're essentially looking at all sorts of different things to create options. We're looking at we're building two new coal units, one of which in southern Indiana is a state-of-the-art integrated gasification combined cycle coal plant that is ready for carbon capture and sequestration, although it's a little difficult to get. Now, this is a plant that's being built as a regulated plant, but without a mandate, it's a little difficult to go into the state of Indiana and secure ratepayer financing of a carbon capture and sequestration for this plant when there is no federal mandate. And, you know, I don't want to say too much, but I mean, when the governor may not be the biggest fan of carbon legislation as well. So, you know, that kind of reality is what we have to deal with. We're also looking at building two nuclear power plants, putting aside, you know, some of the issues around that. You know, zero carbon emissions, very expensive. The economics or the gain that comes from having carbon regulations in a market for market for carbon is very important to the economics of those units if we're going to build them. And with obviously without that signal in place, they become that much harder to build. We are building wind. We are building solar. We are doing both solar on the rooftop, and we're doing solar at a central power plant size level as well. But both of those technologies, again, have a lot of incentives for the federal government, but climate legislation, a carbon price, will help improve their economics as well. We're doing energy efficiency. We're doing a program called Save a Watt in lots of our states, which is essentially trying to get rate structures where saving energy is put on the same footing as building a power plant in terms of the return to our investors and in terms of the cost structure for the customers. And again, all of that is, you can make the case right now, but the case becomes a lot better if there's climate legislation. And again, not to pick on the Hoosier state, but some of our filings on energy efficiency have run into some difficulties. And we look at this and sort of say, but if you take the point of view that there will be, or there is carbon legislation, the economics around some of these programs change dramatically. So we need certainty. We need some idea of what the rules are going to be next year, 2 years down the road, and really for a lot of our investments, 20 years down the road, which is why we're working on federal legislation. However, in the face of where we are right now, what are the likely outcomes and what can we do about them? I mean, one thing is that EPA may step in and regulate. But when I look at that in my checkered career, I worked at EPA for a while, and I'm fairly familiar with the program that they're going to first use to regulate. And it has some pros, but it is not going to create the kind of certainty that we would need in order to understand investment. It's not going to put a price on carbon. The first thing they're going to do is turn on this sort of permitting program, and the strengths and weaknesses of that program is that it only really affects new sources or sources that modify. And to illustrate that, we have in southern Indiana a very large coal-fired power plant that has lots and lots of emissions. It would be unaffected so long as we don't make a modification to that facility. On the other hand, if someone came in and two miles away tried to build a state-of-the-art combined cycle, low emissions, lower, you know, all the kind of at least incremental improvement over a straight coal plant, they would run into this program and have to justify it and have to look at all these different alternatives. So, you know, this is there's a lot of controversy around this, and I'm not trying to say there's no value to these programs, but it's not going to, you know, the kinds of things that EPA is going to do immediately are not going to create the kind of certainty that will allow us to know what investments to make, and are not going to create economics around some of the investments that are necessary to move towards zero carbon in our generation. For the states, it's a little more complicated, and it's a little bit, your point of view is shaped by where you operate, and where we operate primarily are states where we're not viewing state activity as creating something that's incompatible with what we hope will be a national standard. So I don't want to speak for the industry or anything. I would note that at least the news reports are indicating that the Kerry Graham Lieberman trio are talking about preemption for the states. And I don't pretend to understand their motivation. I suspect it's a concern about the complexity of having a national program and then layering on the state program, and the reality that the state, well, there also is an issue around leakage from a state program and what its effect will be if you can essentially, if you over-comply because of a state program, and all that means is you're going to be able to do less in another state under the federal program. So there's some issues around that, and we haven't been that involved in the preemption issue. I'm sure you guys can find an industry advocate who will get all red in the face and pound about it. So, I mean, it's clearly a priority for industry. The other thing I'd say about state regulation is if you look at what the sources of CO2 in the United States are, you know, for better or for worse, coal-fired power and the power sector. The power sector is approximately 40%. Coal-fired power is a large part of that. And then you have mobile sources that are in transportation, broadly defined, are another 40%. And for transportation, it's a little difficult for state programs to impact them. I mean, that's sort of why the Clean Air Act always was built with stationary sources being regulated under state programs with EPA oversight, but transportation being established or regulated through national actions. So you have that problem with transportation. And then for our sector, you know, unless the patchwork of state programs really begins to include all the states where there are major emissions, it's you still have this concern that the U.S. is really not going to be able to meet the kinds of reduction numbers that the president, for instance, mentioned in Copenhagen. So state regulation is important to a lot of industry. There seems to be an operating presumption that there would be some sort of preemption. But we'll, you know, more to play on that. And then let me just, from a point of view of a company that is going to need to be, if we're going to have some sort of cap and market approach to climate, we are going to want to access some of the international sources of offsets. And, you know, EPA and the original Waxman-Markey modeling, if you didn't have international offsets, the program would be, you know, roughly twice as expensive in the initial years. And let me take that and put it in a little different context. If you turn on this program and it's very expensive for the customers, for consumers, it has a chance of blowing up. International offsets coming in early is a way of dampening down the price, you know, the price increases inherent in what we're going to do, or potentially inherent if there's no technology that keeps up with the caps. So international offsets is not just an issue for us. I like to think, our view is it's an important issue for designing a program that will be acceptable. And that, international offsets, as Elliot can talk about with a lot more authority than I can, is going to depend on a series of agreements at the international level, whether it's RED or other types of offsets. So we do have to have some international agreements that allow that are going to be tied to whatever national program we hopefully adopt. Just another point of view we have is that at the end of the day, and we're a company with a high percentage of coal emissions, so we obviously have a prejudice around coal or a point of view around coal. But even if you turn off all the U.S. coal plants, coal still is a huge issue for climate change because of the installation of power plants in China and other parts of the country. So solving the CO2 issue around coal to us is very important, whether you just view it as part of what the U.S. needs to do, or if you think coal should go away completely in the U.S., you still have to deal with it in other parts of the world. So we have been working for the last year developing partnerships with Chinese companies because we view China as, because they're moving forward on coal so aggressively, we also think that they're going to move forward quicker on some of the traditional and non-traditional solutions, everything from growing algae to create a biofuel from CO2 to doing better carbon capture and sequestration from an existing pulverized coal power plant. So, that exposes more of a bottom-up example where we're looking to create to capitalize on some of the work that's going on there, their ability to do things, to put together the capital, put together the projects faster. And in a way, it may be that clean coal technology or zero carbon technology is coming in from China into the U.S. rather than the other way around, which is not exactly what the Secretary of Commerce wants to hear. But, we're exploring all these things. We think at the end of the day, they're all healthy for coming up with a zero carbon solution for the electricity sector. And, as we sit here today and with what's going on in the Hill and what took place internationally, you really can have a great half-empty, half-full debate. I think what, again, sort of to revisit what I said earlier, I think what the healthcare bill teaches us a little bit is there's a lot of conventional wisdom around this town, a lot of group thinking about what's, where things are and how dead they are and everything. And, this is not Newtonian physics. So, I think there's actually a reasonable possibility that there's legislation this year. I also think that there are lots of other ways that some sort of certainty, especially for the utility sector with 40% of the emissions, where we can get the right signals so we're making the investment into the kinds of energy projects that will reduce emissions, so we'll be on that glide path. So, we can talk about that more, but this it's not all or nothing in terms of whether Kerry Graham Lieberman succeeds or not, and they might surprise us. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Bill. That was fantastic. One of the things that we certainly can take the message away that it's not sort of an all or nothing proposition as we posed it. But one of the sort of questions that I have in sort of looking at framing this issue is whether or not the current environment is different than the one that sort of characterized the patchwork as we saw it in the 2000s, right? So in a lot of ways during that period of time, there were high prices for energy, a very different sort of economic outlook. And as Kate had mentioned in her list of things that drive sort of state-level policymaking, there's a lot of reasons for folks at the state and local level, folks around the world, to be driving towards pursuing very aggressive energy and climate policies. And I guess the question is now, with all the discussion we hear sort of within the context of the Hill debate, but also, you know, in the context of what other countries are doing on climate change or what's going on at the state level, is now sort of fundamentally different? Has something changed? Have people gotten far enough into sort of implementing their climate policies or their energy policies, whether it's through these regional greenhouse gas cap and trade programs or policies that are being enacted in other countries around the world, that they've started to see that it's difficult, that they've started to see that it's actually paying off? And so if we do have sort of this lag or this absence of coordinated policy, is there as much momentum for the kind of policies that drove us to get to a place where we were looking towards having something more sort of globally or nationally coordinated, or has some of that fallen off? And so I didn't know if, you know, Kate or Elliot wanted to sort of talk about what they think is sort of the support out there for a lot of these bottom-up confidence-building measures and whether they think those are generally positive or negative or more negative than they were before.
I'll try. I would say it's probably a little of both. This is, folks, hear me okay? You know, I think the states have the same economic problems that everybody has. They have budget problems, and they have worries about votes and elections, and the economy is bad pretty much all across the country, and it's hard to pass things that people worry will raise prices for anything. And so I think the states have challenges in getting in these programs up and running. I think they also have some really strong models of where it's really working, and I think seeing Reggie functioning, seeing Reggie have 7 auctions, seeing Reggie raise a lot of money that they're spending on a lot of really great programs the states have wanted to do for a long time, I think that has to be an encouraging model for the idea that it can work and it can work well.
I think at the international level, a couple of things that have changed are that the science, despite things we've heard in the recent months, which from our perspective don't actually get at any of the fundamental science, that I think internationally there is a greater sense of urgency driven by the science. And I think we saw that's one of the reasons we saw the higher level of political engagement we did over the past year. I mean, I think that, you know, the Copenhagen deadline, while I think the notion that we would get to a legal treaty was unrealistic, I think the deadline nonetheless did serve to elevate the issue on the international agenda and engage leaders. So I think that's an important new element. You also came out of there with some concrete pledges. Now, I wouldn't say that all countries are yet acting. Some of us are putting pledges on paper, and only time will tell whether we act. But some countries are acting. some are further along in their actions, and I think one of the things that we see flowing from that is a recognition that there are other side benefits that flow from some of these actions, for instance, commercial returns. And now, you know, for a long time, people in this town were worried, well, China's never going to act, why should we? And now people are beginning to worry, oh, China's acting, and they're going to get ahead of us in this global competition for the clean energy market. So I think that's introduced a new dynamic. I think one thing that really hasn't changed, and which may be at this stage the most important constraint on international progress, is that we still don't have comprehensive climate and energy legislation in the United States.
That does bring up an interesting element. And when we talked about here several weeks ago when we did sort of a green stimulus debate, and we were talking about sort of the Green New Deal and green protectionism and the fact that a lot of the positive energy around some of these climate and energy policies now are really driven by the economic opportunity aspect of it. But at the same time, sort of absent sort of a global approach to dealing with energy and climate policy, realizing some of those near-term economic benefits has come with, you know, some potential for protectionist policies that try and keep those kinds of benefits at the domestic level as opposed to sort of spreading them out along global supply chains, which from sort of an international perspective, the idea was always if you're able to sort of internationalize these processes and drive down the cost of technologies, everyone benefits and the climate policy ends up being less expensive. There's a big timing question here. You know, Elliot, you talked a lot about sort of confidence building, but in terms of us not having a lot of time to do that, we can't take the, you know, trade agenda 10-year route to get to an international agreement. But at the same time, with this, are we sort of running into an issue on the trade agenda part of it? And then in terms of, and Bill, if you've got some comments on this too, that'd be interesting. Whereas if we do have policies in different countries acting at different levels with different drivers, you know, say this competitiveness being one of them, is there a risk of having sort of trade wars, so to speak, that come from not having a level carbon sort of playing field out there? And is that a big concern in terms of not having sort of that top-down coordination and having more of a bottom-up approach?
I think there's the risk, certainly. And I think that one of the issues to be very carefully managed at this stage is avoiding that. I guess having a more uniform top-down approach would be one way. I mean, ideally, from some perspectives, what you want to get toward is this, global cap and trade approach, where we've all got we're all using the same mechanisms to price carbon within our economies, and that effectively provides you with the level playing field. It's a beautiful ideal, and maybe someday we'll get there. But in the meantime, I think we're going to have to work with different approaches that are not going to be harmonized and that create that do not provide for a perfectly level playing field, and I think we're going to have to resist the temptation as long as possible to resort to measures like trade border measures to try to create that level playing field that might actually have unintended consequences.
Just to add to that, There certainly is a strong interest, at least in some of the senators, in led by Senator Brown from Ohio, in creating some sort. If there is going to be a cap and it is going to cover trade exposed industry, then there has to be some sort of protection against countries or competitors that don't have the same carbon burden. And, again, there's a lot of policy arguments to be made under that, I think, and to traffic and sort of what I was making fun of up there. But, I mean, to traffic and sort of conventional wisdom, it seems to be the point of view that something's going to have to be done with that point of view, because it's not going to be sufficient to, I mean, it's not going to be ignored as if there is a full deal. I think one thing that will happen is that there's generally a point of view that we should phase in industry this on the stationary source side, and the utility industry is looking like it would be the first sector covered by a cap. And, you know, I don't know what EEI's official position is on that, but trying to deal with the trade-exposed industry, it looks like they're putting that off in, 4, 6, 8 years off, for better or for worse.
The other thing is, we sort of danced around the issue of sort of U.S. legislation, which is really important both to what happens at the state level and at the international level. And we did try and get somebody from the Hill to come down and talk about the KGL bill, but the current efforts to have some sort of climate energy legislation, and surprisingly, no one took our offer. But one of the things is we're hearing a lot, and I hate to ask my colleagues to sort of speculate on things that are sort of rumor now, but I will. are there things that we're seeing in sort of this current iteration of national level policy, because it's so important both to what's going on at the state level and at the international level, that are of potential concern about how those things continue to emerge? Some examples, Bill brought up sort of the offset issue and how important that is for a number of goals, both sort of at the international level and this sort of the preemption issue. I mean, are there ways that that in order to get compromise or to address some of the concerns about the previous iterations of energy and climate legislation, that this bill is being changed, or you're hearing discussions that are making it potentially more problematic for us ultimately reaching that sort of good marriage between top-down, bottom-up policy that we were talking about?
Probably not surprisingly from my presentation, and Bill mentioned the rumors going around, we're concerned about preemption.
Yeah.
We haven't seen the bill. I don't know what's in there, but we're hearing the same rumors that there may be quite a bit more preemption than we've seen before the states. And we're concerned, really, for me, it's a really good fallback plan. It's really hard to get the federal legislation right. We really want them to get it right. It's difficult to get enough people on board. And the nice thing about having the states there is that if for some reason you don't get it right, they can step in and fill in gaps. And it's not a trivial thing for states to do. It's not something they do lightly. They have to be reelected. Their legislatures have to be reelected. Their governors are reelected. It's cost to entities in their states who they're regulating. So it's not like they would sort of toss off their own rules on a whim. And so it's nice that they have the opportunity to go further than the federal government if need be. And we're concerned they might not maintain that authority.
Mm-hmm. I think one question is to what degree the international process may or may not serve as a driver for the domestic legislation. It's never been my perception that it is a significant driver. Now, in this case, you have the U.S. having put forward a pledge of achieving a reduction, economy-wide reduction, of in the range of 17% in 2020, but it's contingent on legislation. Mm-hmm. I think that, having put that forward, it will serve as something of a driver for the administration in terms of continuing to push for legislation. I don't think it's necessarily something that is really felt by the Hill. So I don't see the international process as a direct driver on the Hill, only indirectly through the administration. But, depending on the direction the legislation winds up going, it could make it difficult for the U.S. to actually fulfill that pledge. I mean, if it is utilities only or utilities first, then are we going to be in a position to meet a target of 17% below 2005? Yeah. Another serious question is whether the U.S. will be in a position to produce its presumed share of the finance that's been promised for 2020. The Copenhagen Accord talks about $100 billion by 2020 from both public and private sources, and there's no breakdown in the accord of who's responsible for how much, but generally it's presumed that the U.S. share of that would be roughly 20%. Under the House bill, the Waxman-Markey bill, you can see how through the use of international offsets and through the set-asides of allowances, the U.S. actually would be in a position to generate 20% of that figure in 2020. If we have a scaled-down bill with fewer international offsets, perhaps no set-asides for international purposes, suddenly you're left wondering, well, where's that going to come from? So I think there are some important considerations there.
Well, you know, the challenging part, again, on this is that they're trying to deal with that, as you said, they're trying to deal with past issues around Waxman-Markey, other bills. The architecture for us may be somewhat straightforward because there's more acceptance around cap and trade. It's something that's been used to implement an SO2 program, a successful SO2 program, so all the sources are somewhat familiar with it and everything. We look like we're heading towards a world where the transportation sector or the fuel sector will be covered by something called a linked fee, very important architecture around whether this fee is under the cap and really is going to have environmental integrity or not. There's political issues around that in terms of that, the Exxon Mobil, I'm a little concerned, will take a fee that's being imposed on gasoline that, sort of looks and smells and quacks like a tax and start running around saying Congress just passed this huge fuels tax. So how you integrate all this, I mean, putting aside the political issues, if they can pull off this system where it's sort of cap and trade for stationary sources or some sort of version of that, and it's a fee for, and it's essentially a revenue-generating facility for fuels. I mean, how does that then create both a cap with integrity, and then how does it plug back into the international system and both support the kinds of commitments we made and also take advantage of the kinds of flexibilities that are available at the international level? And those are all very difficult questions to figure out.
Well, we've got some time for some questions. We do have a couple rules, ground rules. Please, you know, state your name and affiliation, wait for a microphone, and also please state your question in the form of a question. So I think we've got one right there.
Hi, Jeff Hopkins from Rio Tinto. I was interested in the comments on competitiveness and impacts on energy-intensive trade-exposed industries if we don't have a global agreement. You know, a lot of the well, I guess the objective is to look at industries that produce global commodities and how do you overlay a global commodity trade on top of a climate trade. And I was wondering, Elliot, in particular, if you could react to the idea of a delay and whether that helps or hurts address the concerns of EITE industries, a U.S. delay. So you delay, I guess, the EITE industry from the U.S. cap. What other versions of legislation had done was go ahead and include them, but compensate them for their compliance costs. That was one model. Then you put off the border adjustments until, you know, 2025. If you delay them, you don't have this negotiation time, it seems to me, before 2025 to avoid protectionism and some of the things that you talk about that need to be managed very carefully. Is putting off EITE industry for a number of years the kind of careful management, or will it make it better or make it worse?
So if I understand correctly, you're suggesting that by putting it off, we may in fact be losing some of the leverage in the negotiations that we would have if we covered the export exposed, the trade exposed manufacturing industries and threatened the use of border measures to protect them.
Maybe it takes the pressure.
There's first a careful balancing of competing domestic interests that have to be taken into account, and then that of course intersects with a whole different slate of competing or conflicting international interests. I mean, I think you highlight an interesting tension there. I mean, from our perspective, it would be best for the purposes of climate protection to have an economy-wide cap and to have all the major entities covered from the start. Now, we would support the use of the output-based allowances to address the transition costs for the trade-exposed industries. As you know, we've never been big fans of the use of trade measures. You know, there were some versions in play in the House debate last year that we thought were, you know, more acceptable than what wound up in the House bill. I think that if the delay is part of what's necessary to actually get legislation through, then I think that's something we would be willing to consider. And if there's some trade-off there that somehow we lose some leverage in the negotiations, I think that's probably outweighed by the benefit of having a mandatory law in place that finally sends a clear signal to the international community that, yes, the United States is serious about reducing its emissions.
Thank you. Lisa Friedman from ClimateWire, and thanks for doing this. I wanted to ask you, Elliot, maybe you, Bill, going back to the comments you made about the kind of changing dynamic and people starting to recognize the amount of investment and effort that China and others are making. I mean, if part of the traditional argument in Congress against the climate bill has been You know, we're going to act, China and India won't, the, you know, the we're going to lose competitiveness to these countries, and, you know, emissions are just going to go up over there, negating, you know, whatever we do. So now you have the major developing countries making pledges, not all of them acting on them yet, but some of them. And you have this tremendous amount of investment from China, from India. Their solar project is huge, and other countries. And I'm wondering, as both of you are on the Hill and talking to members, has that changed that argument in any fundamental way? Is that still hold? Are you still hearing from members, you know, hey, China and India and others aren't going to do anything? Or has what happened in Copenhagen and since made any difference in that dynamic? Thanks.
I don't know that we're in a position to say, I'm in a position to say it's changed votes or something. But I think that there is more recognition that how aggressively lots of different countries are moving into both clean tech. And in the U.S., you certainly have some of the leading venture capitalists testifying on the Hill about how the U.S. is behind on wind, on solar, on some of the key technologies. I think what we're finding is it's a little more complicated to tell the coal story, but we have the point of view that China is actually making as much or more progress than the U.S. is on some of the important technologies around bringing that fuel into the sort of post-climate future or carbon-reduced future. So those are all fact. You know, those stories are getting out. They're being considered. But this whole issue around competitiveness remains very, very visceral. And I think the trade exposed industries that we're talking about, partly because they're amongst the biggest victims of the current recession, I think their story still resonates very strongly. Their concerns resonates very strongly. For what it's worth, and a senator who I wasn't there, so I won't say the name, but told a story to our CEO and basically said, you know, we did focus groups. This is a Republican senator. We did focus groups around climate, and when we talked about, you know, avoiding catastrophic climate change, the meter moved a tiny bit. When we talked about climate as a jobs bill, you know, it moved a little bit. When we talked about climate, the importance of passing climate legislation so we don't lose economic leadership to China, the thing went, you know, all the way to 100%. So, you know, I think there's a way to use this issue to help support the need for the U.S. to act, but I can't tell you that it's, you know, it's changed a single vote at the moment.
I think we're hearing less of the traditional line of argument that China and India aren't going to act, so therefore we shouldn't be imposing mandatory legislation on the United States. I think the fact that that all of the major developing countries have inscribed specific actions into the accord and agreed, at least in principle, to some measure of accountability has blunted that argument. I think people clearly recognize that we now need to actually elaborate a system of transparency and accountability to follow through and ensure that they're held accountable. But I hear much more attention these days on the jobs and economy side of the question and the fact that these countries are moving to position themselves in those markets. And I think it's helped to if not turn around the competitiveness argument in the United States, at least broaden it. I mean, historically, we've focused really on only one dimension of the potential competitiveness impacts here. the impact on the traditional energy-intensive industries. And that remains an important concern, but I think there is now a recognition of another important dimension to the competitiveness equation, and that's that there are many industries in the United States that would benefit competitively from having in place here regulatory drivers for action that would give them the incentives to develop the technologies and compete in those markets.
Ian Talley, Dow Jones Newswires. I'm wondering if you could discuss a little bit about the politics of getting 60 votes for Kerry Lieberman Graham. So, for example, Bingaman, having been decidedly against revenue sharing, states revenue sharing, and that being discussed as what to get some Republicans on board, or Sanders and Boxer saying that they wouldn't do anything that was too weak. Cantwell Collins saying they want no market, but a straight utilities only and distribution, et cetera, et cetera. And secondly, bubbles are created through false demand. And while mainstream science scientists do not debate the climate change, they do debate the extent to which it will change. So the temperature fluctuation determines the carbon reductions needed, which determine the clean energy demand. Is there a case for a carbon bubble in the future, given the models being so imperfect?
Let me just to address the second one, because we operate in North Carolina, South Carolina, Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky in terms of our regulated businesses, and then our some of our non-regulated businesses, like our renewable business, operates all over the country. But and we operate internationally as well. But if you think of those states I mentioned where our core utility franchises are, if you know, there is not a strong consensus here around what is happening on climate. And so this is a question that we get asked a lot. And it's also, I mean, our business isn't to be, our business is to be good citizens. Our business is to be good stewards of our shareholders' investments. So playing, you know, trying to be policy advocates is not something that we're supposed to do. However, when we look at this issue and we look at the kinds of activities that you would do if you believe that carbon reductions are on the horizon, I mean, it's pretty consistent with other economic drivers. Fundamentally, you're just talking about reducing the amount of natural resources that go into creating a kilowatt of electricity, and that, you know, that's always going to be more efficient, more cost-effective. But if you look at all the different things that I mentioned, that we're the options we're building, they all have a business case that doesn't require carbon. Carbon will add to the business case of a lot of them. And really, the only one you reach that sort of says if there's no climate, if climate policy is going to fall away at some point in the future. The only thing we're looking at right now, and we're really not doing it yet, because we won't do it unless there's a mandate, is looking at taking existing coal-fired power plants and putting in a giant contraption to capture their carbon and do something with it. So that's about the only activity of new nuclear power plants, you know, new solar, new wind, energy efficiency, smart grid, all the various things that we're spending billions of dollars in capital on. That's really the only one that where you start to go, well, you know, this is dependent on whether the carbon policy and its justifications in the underlying science are going to stay steady and be there. And that one we're not, you know, we'll do as sort of following what the mandates are. Trying to get ahead of the technology and understand it and be ready, but we aren't going to make huge investments, and we aren't going to be allowed to make huge investments unless there's a pretty strong policy recommend or mandate there. So,
I had 2 points I wanted to offer in response to the question of the bubble. I'm not sure I want to speak to the first question about the politics, but and I think Bill has just made my first point that most of the things we're talking about in the near term are no regrets policies, things that provide other benefits apart from reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So there's a strong case for doing them, even if it turns out we're completely wrong about climate change. My other point was that given the trajectory we appear to be on, I'm not so concerned about us overacting and going too far. If anything, my concern is the opposite. So, I'm not too worried about creating a bubble.
Okay, I don't think you're going to get any takers on your first question. All right. Where was it?
Yeah, again, Paul Genoa with the Nuclear Energy Institute. And the question goes to a couple points that were made. If you accept the premise that to really solve the climate challenge, you need to deploy clean technology, you really need to transition certainly the power sector away from carbon and then transport and industry and so forth. And the question is, does the perfect become the enemy of the good? If you have to deploy the technology, then obviously a robust price on carbon would do the job. But if, getting to the gentleman's question, if the politics just don't allow you to take an aggressive enough stance on establishing a price on carbon, in other words, if the price is too weak, the investment still won't be made. You see that in Europe right now. Bill talked about the challenge of financing new nuclear. The UK has made a pitch to really go back into nuclear in a big way, and they're not going to subsidize it. On the other side of the coin, though, they realize that absent a certain floor on the price of carbon, they're not going to get that investment made. It won't happen. So the question is then, if you can't get that price, do other things such as mandates make it easier to go ahead and drive that, like through a clean portfolio standard? You're going to have the support of the investment that will generate jobs and some of the competitiveness issues you looked at, and you actually get action on the ground. And while it may not be the desirable market-based system, it does drive action. I'd like your comments on that.
I'm going to actually take this question. You had a question, right, as well? And was there another one over here? Okay. And back there, just to gather them up, we're kind of towards the end of our time, so I want to make sure we get them in.
Okay. This is a question for Mr. Derringer. My name is Michael Davidson from Asia Policy Point. I wanted to get back to the UNFCCC negotiations and sort of get your feedback on where you see the current negotiation process taking. You said in maybe within a few years, 3-4, we could have a binding target. I wanted to see if that was following the current sort of Kyoto Protocol Bali roadmaps strategy, or are you seeing something new emerging, right? I mean, a lot of people have said, at least from the developed countryside, that we need something new to replace that, but the developing countries have been very opposed to that. I wanted to get your comments on the likelihood of a change in the current process taking. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, Nicholas Foster from the Center for Transatlantic Relations. I'd like to get back to the bottom-up approach, and I was wondering about if Mr. Tindall could comment a little bit about Duke's. You mentioned Duke started decarbonizing in the 90s voluntarily, and I was wondering if you could mention the feedback effect this has had on climate legislation that's currently being debated, and also other utilities or other companies in the private sector, and basically what leverage is there from the bottom up side on the private sector. Thanks.
About sort of the mandate route versus, or due to lack of action, the UNFCCC process change question, and then this last one. Anyone?
Well, on the nuclear issue, the whole question of how you're going to get next generation technologies out there without asking consumers to swallow a carbon price that'll directly drive them is important, because things like, I mean, even going back to carbon capture and sequestration, initially it's going to be very expensive technology. If you want, you know, the carbon price that's needed for that right now would be $50, $60, $70, $80, $100 per ton. And, you know, I don't think there'll be a single senator or House member of the House of Representatives who would vote for a bill that envisioned that kind of price in the short term. So you have this gap between what we can do and, you know, what is politically feasible when we turn on a carbon system in the U.S., carbon regulatory scheme in the U.S., and the need to pull forward some of these technologies, and I would put nuclear power in that. And I think that that's why you've got to have other programs that whether you're using allowances to feed that, which is sort of one of the things that's going on, or whether you have other kinds of proposals that are based on getting money to push some of these projects on a demonstration basis or on getting a few established so that we make the commercial case. I think that has to be done. An interesting point yesterday, Senator Rockefeller introduced a bill that created a wire charge that would create a pot of money to push carbon capture and sequestration for coal plants, which is obviously very important to him. There is almost a universal view, I don't want to say universal, but a strong point of view in the Senate that whatever comes forward on climate needs to have a title that brings some U.S. Nuclear power plants into existence, because we're falling behind on that technology. It's zero emissions. China's building nuclear power plants. Lots of other countries in the world are building them, and this key, maybe even national security technology that the U.S. developed is slowly becoming, offshore and not it's something where the U.S. has an expertise. On the other issue, I mean, the only thing I would say about what we did early is that, it's a lot of hard work by Jim Rogers, our CEO, other CEOs in the industry. But when the Blaxman-Markey bill was being marked up, the Edison Electric Institute, the trade association for the utility industry, was I think the only major trade association to support the legislation, moving the legislation forward, which is a pretty major victory from the point of view of where things were, say, when we first made our carbon pledge.
I'll make a couple comments on the question about whether the price signal is strong enough and whether additional policies would help. And that's that, again, you're seeing that the state labs at work, which is that a lot of those maps that I showed earlier overlap a lot in the states that have, in REGI, for example, also have RPSs. A lot of them have public benefit funds and a variety of other policies that I think add together to create that greatest influx of capital Maine has seen that Dave Littell was talking about in the quote I showed. So I think they can work really well together. And the other thing I'll say is that it's really hard to know what the federal policy should be, what the right limits are, what the right prices are, and how that's all going to play out over time as the science evolves and as technologies evolve. And even if you knew what the answer was, it'd probably be really hard to pass that to the question about the politics before. And so I think that's one of the reasons that the flexibility of the bottom-up approach continues to be so important, even once there is federal policy, because it's a lot easier to go back and iterate that through a lot of policymakers than it is to get it right today for the next 50 years.
So on the UNFCCC process, unfortunately, it's left in something of a state of confusion coming out of Copenhagen. I said earlier that I think the immediate priority is to operationalize the Copenhagen Accord. Unfortunately, because of the way things went down in the final hours in Copenhagen, the accord itself has no formal standing in the process. So while many parties would view it as the new foundation for going forward, the process can't formally proceed in that way. But I do think that it can, in a de facto way, proceed with the decisions that are needed to, in fact, operationalize the accord within the agenda under the convention track in the negotiations. You have all the items that one needs to take decisions on in order to put the accord into effect. So, I mean, my worry is that the first time a party comes into the negotiations and says we need to do these things because the Copenhagen Accord says so, some other party is going to stand up and say, well, that thing has no standing here, and we'll wind up in this procedural debate that could last the entire year. So, I think it will take some diplomatic finesse to find a workaround. But I think that if we can approach it with some finesse, we could produce decisions by the end of the year that elaborate the accord on a de facto basis. Now, I think that may also require putting off for some time the question of the ultimate legal form of a future binding treaty, because we are still stuck with these two tracks that we came into Copenhagen with, the Kyoto track and the convention track. The Kyoto supporters are not going to give that up until they see what this alternative future agreement is going to look like. And I think that's one of the benefits of beginning to build out the regime. They can start to see it take shape and gain some comfort around that. And hopefully, at some point in the not-too-distant future, we can get people buying into the notion that really what's most sensible is a single comprehensive binding agreement that gets us past these two tracks.
Well, before we break up, I just wanted to sort of mention, I forgot at the beginning to mention that this is part of a series of events that we're doing this year called the Opportunity Tipping Point Series, which is all about the policies and investments and private sector activity that sort of lead us towards this low-carbon energy future. So next event will be April 15th. It actually focuses on the nexus between food, water, and energy issues and the climate impacts and how to build sort of adaptation strategies so it helps enable sort of this transition. So stay tuned for that announcement. I just wanted to ask you to join me in thanking our great panelists for talking about this great and important issue that will likely keep evolving, whether it's from the top down or the bottom up, over the next couple years. And thank you for all of your time and being here with us today. So.